Welcome to Arriving Late, everyone. This is the podcast that is going to reintroduce me to 1990s television science fiction, the shows that I missed at the time because I was busy. I always hear my friends talking about shows like The Next Generation and Deep Space Nine, Farscape, and stuff like that, shows I've never seen. And I decided to get in on the conversation and to make a podcast about it. The way we're going about it is we're going to watch the pilots of the various shows to decide which one we want to look deeper into first and then kind of move through them as we go along. And so tonight we're going to be looking at Star Trek Enterprise, the very controversial show that came out around 2000 and really divided the Star Trek community. And so we're going to be doing the two-hour pilot tonight. I'm Jake McMillan.
And I'm Mike Slocum.
Yes, and we are going to get started right now with the worst theme song for any television show ever made.
It wasn't that bad.
I mean, I have to say this because I really liked this show. And my overall, you know, impression of Enterprise, of the pilot, is very high, except for that one thing. I just really hate that song.
Well, fortunately, we can skip it. So
yeah, so we do have the skip intro button. Yeah, you can listen to it by yourself later. I'm going to skip it.
That's okay. I'm good.
Yeah, so this Star Trek Enterprise, the conceit behind this is that they went for the prequel here. So this is actually a show that takes place before the original series, about 100 years before Kirk. We have Captain Archer and the very first iteration of the Starship Enterprise. And the episode opens up with kind of an interesting bit of action. Well, first of all, we see young Captain Archer as a boy. His father is teaching him about warp engines. His father is the guy who will eventually perfect the warp engine for humans. But then we cut to a chase with a Klingon being chased through a cornfield by a couple of Suliban. Well, these are Suliban, of course, are creatures we've not encountered before in the Star Trek universe. And there's a shootout there. The Sulibans are killed, and a farmer carrying a gun that looks very much like a 12-gauge shotgun, but shoots plasma bullets, gets a nice chest shot right center body mass on the Klingon, and then we cut to the terrible song. And so
yes, that's how the show. But let's not forget the little bit of action from the Klingon. He lures the Suliban into, I guess it was a methane silo, something that sits out in a cornfield, I guess, in the future, instead of a grain silo or something else. Lures them in, jumps out an up a top floor window and uses some weapon to completely blow the smithereens out of this thing and scatter those Suliban all over the cornfield. So they can't be found by anybody.
I think if that was really full of methane, like they said, he could have done that with a cigarette lighter.
Right? Probably. and we wonder what happens to his weapon after that. Because as you say, he then encounters the farmer with the plasma rifle who takes him out.
Yeah.
Maybe he lost his gun in the explosion.
Well, he's knocked down, right, by the explosion. So maybe he, yes. I think that he just lost his gun. Because Klingons are not known for shooting second.
No, not known for shooting second. And not known for running away either. But yeah. In this case, we have, I guess, a reasoned Klingon, or a Klingon who has something to be gained by not getting killed and going to the afterlife with honor.
Right, right. He actually does try to communicate with the farmer. But everything a Klingon says sounds like a shouted insult.
Yes.
So the farmer is just like, well, better safe than sorry. Boom.
Sorry. Boom. those aggressive humans, man.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we don't belong in the universe, obviously. Yep. After the terrible theme song, we cut back to the action and we find Captain Archer, along with, I guess, Starfleet Command and a bunch of Vulcans who are in sort of like an operating theater looking at the Klingon who's being operated on by an alien doctor. And they're trying to decide what to do with him.
Yes. We get some interesting insight into the Vulcans that we didn't have from earlier series. There's a little conflict going on, some tension between the Vulcans, who seem to be hindering the humans or downplaying to them not being extremely helpful. And they make a suggestion.
They do. They make a suggestion that it might make more sense to let the Klingon die because that's what he wants anyway.
Right. Go on to the after. That's what Klingons want. They want to die with honor. And Archer kind of goes, what?
Yeah. What? And that's kind of the first indication that we're not going to have a TNG type Star Trek. This is going to be a original series Star Trek with a hot-headed, emotional captain.
Yep.
Which I found very exciting because I kind of find TNG a little bit boring.
At least from the pilots.
Yeah. I should say here actually that our first podcast was supposed to be on the TNG pilot incident at Farpoint Station. And that pilot was so boring, and the podcast was then so boring that we've kind of trashed it, and we're going to put TNG back to a later date to do something else, different episodes.
Maybe we'll go universe chronology instead of released chronology.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Maybe it'll make more sense.
So this is actually a really fascinating scene right here because you've got all the major players in one room. And we find out that unlike in the future, when we seem to be very strong allies with the Vulcans, there's a lot of tension here. And right out of the box, Archer accuses them of holding information back from the humans.
Yes. As a matter of fact, the humans have been deferring to the Vulcans for 100 years. Looks like Archer really, really wants to stick it to them.
Well, he has a grudge to bear because his father was working on the warp engine and the Vulcans did not give him enough information for him to finish it before he died.
Yep.
So, yeah, he's got no love for the Vulcans. The Vulcans, really have no respect for the humans. The looks on their faces, they're supposed to be unemotional, but they always seem to be kind of sneering at the humans.
Yes. Humans appear to be beneath them at this point.
And probably so. I mean, they live to be 200 years. They've had warp engines forever. You know, we're just like the young.
And we shoot plasma rifles at the first alien we see.
Yes. Yeah. And if he had been here on a diplomatic mission, we'd be at war with the Klingons now.
Klingons, yes. So let's not forget, we had a little vignette, a trip to the ship where they flew around it. They did the classic Star Trek pilot where they have to introduce the ship. You have to fly around it, see all of the interesting exteriors, and here's their CGI budget for the year.
that was the same with TNG. They spent all of their budget in the opening scene giving us a flyby of the ship.
Yep. We do discover that that they have a flaky transporter that they are not willing to send people through, maybe non-biological items.
Yeah, that's true. And once we get on board the Enterprise, let's go ahead and hold on for a second here and kind of catch up because essentially what has happened is there's been an argument between the humans and the Klingons, and Archer has proposed that they take the Klingon back to Kronos.
Yes.
Obviously the Vulcans are against it. They don't want the humans to do anything. I can't remember how Archer ends up winning the argument, but he does.
Well, he basically convinces the Admiral that this is going to be humans' chance to get out there and actually do something. Mm-hmm. And why would they kill the Klingon when they can return him and win favor with this race that they've never met?
Right. Right. So they decide this is going to be the Enterprise's maiden voyage. This is a completely new ship. And once we get inside, you'll see that it looks like a prototype.
It's the bridge is functional and utilitarian. Mm-hmm. It looks like it's got lots of extra diagnostics and switches. It's all mm-hmm. compact. There's not a lot of space. It looks like something that you'd really use, really put in a bridge, as opposed to other shows where it looked like a lounge.
Right. And timeline wise, in the Star Trek universe, this takes place 100 years after the first warp engine test, which is what attracted the Vulcans to us, to the humans.
Yes.
Which was in that movie, a TNG movie about the Borg.
Yep.
Right. So it's been 100 years since then. And in that time, Archer tells us that they have wiped out poverty and war on planet Earth.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm assuming that the part of the leverage for doing that was the discovery of alien races.
Yeah. Nothing like an external challenge to bring people together.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So basically that's what the decision is. They're going to take the Klingon, who is unconscious, back to Kronos. And now we get to meet kind of all of the key characters, the characters who are going to be key in this series. Starting with Trip.
Yep.
Who I guess is the chief engineer and an old friend of Captain Archer's.
I believe from the Academy. And who can be annoying sometimes.
He's, yeah.
He's quite a character.
He will be carrying the banner of anachronistic attitudes.
Yes.
For us.
Into the future.
And who's the British guy now? What does he do?
I can't remember what his role is. Okay. I don't even have his name in front of me. Well, yep. Yeah. They have the linguist Hoshi, who they've lured from a teaching position at the Academy, because she gets to now go and investigate all those wonderful Klingon dialects that nobody has ever heard on Earth.
Yeah. She's my annoying character. As we get into it, but yeah, so, you know, Archer wants her specifically. He goes and, you know, basically pries her away from her, her teaching job right in the middle of the semester.
Yep. And as you've mentioned before, they don't appear to have universal translators, so they need a good linguist.
Right. Because what she says in there is the translator has a problem locking onto to the Klingon's dialect when we get to that point. So they have the translator, but it may not be as functional as the one from the original series and the other series.
Yes.
So she's important. And my favorite character is Dr. Phlox. And this guy is just, he's almost like an outer space hippie. You know, he's just, he's always happy. He's always curious. He's just thrilled to be there. And he finds humans to be really interesting. And as he says, you're so frail, yet so optimistic.
Yes. And he has wonderful, wonderful remedies that we will discover later.
Yes, yeah, they're all gross. They're all medieval.
Yes.
It all involves some kind of insect, either going in you or...
on you or around you.
Yes.
Or some other eel or slug or paste or something.
Yeah, so he's sort of like intergalactic natural medicine, you know, which another thing I love, you know, because he's so... different from Bones, who has the tricorder and, you know, all that kind of stuff. And, you know, this guy basically has a box full of animals.
That's right. And some that you don't want to get too close to.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then let us not forget our Vulcan science officer.
Oh, right. Right. And man, I would say, you know, if you had to choose the most beautiful woman in the Star Trek universe, it would probably be Jolene Blaylock. The second place would be, what's her name? Jerry Ryan, 7 of 9. Was that Jerry Ryan?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They try to give us one that was real, just knockout for every series, I guess.
Something for the teenage boys, I guess.
Yeah. And they do, play up Jolene Blaylock's looks quite a bit. In this episode.
Oh, yes.
So they were going after the fanboys and the team boys, you know, with that. And I don't know if it worked or not. I don't think it did. Yes. So the Doctor, Jolene Blaylock, those are my two favorite characters in the show. Jolene, Jolene, I'm sorry, T'Pol is her character's name. And T'Pol is a fascinating Vulcan to me because, of course, she starts off really hostile. Okay, so they're getting the ship ready to go, and Trip and the English guy and the Boomer, which is interesting because is he Commander Tucker or is that Trip?
That's Trip, Commander Tucker. Tucker.
Okay,
I can't remember Boomer's name, but yes, interesting that he's actually a cargo carrier pilot,
that confused me a little bit because like they're saying, well, this is the first time we're going to get out there, but this guy grew up on a freighter.
Yes. I think that, the interesting part is, they've had warp drive, but not very fast and not very, clearly they had warp drive 100 years ago, but maybe only warp one or, you know, maybe only warp two.
Human settlements or something, you know, I'm not really
sure. Or you know, around the solar system, or you know, maybe nearby systems. Because the big thing about the Enterprise, it's the first warp 5 vessel that the humans have managed to manufacture.
And the interesting thing there too is that Starfleet doesn't have enough officers or men to actually man the ship. They're going out and getting boomers and, you know, teachers and people like that, trying to put a fleet together.
Yes. Alien doctors, Vulcan science officers.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's kind of a nice, look at a sort of a slapdash effort to at the last minute, put something, a ship together and go, you know, which is really how humans do it.
Yes, they do.
Yeah. So they're on the ship, and we have to see the transporter, and everybody is nervous about the transporter now. It used to just be Bones, right?
Yes.
But they won't send anything biological through it at this point. It's just supplies.
Yes. Well, of course, you know, even then, it's like I would be hesitant to send anything critical through that if they're not convinced it's gonna, you know, okay. You know, send blankets and stuff, but don't send any sensitive equipment or electronics. Yeah. Who knows what's going to happen?
Yeah. So that's really interesting that the transporter technology is new to them.
Yes. But it still has the sliders.
Yeah. That bothers me. It just worries me that a guy has to push 3 sliders up to a certain position or what happens?
You know? Or simultaneously, right. You know, not just... It's like, don't stretch. Don't make him a little too wide or a little too tall.
Right. So we don't know what the 3 sliders are, but you know, I would much prefer it if you just pressed a button and the machines took care of putting my pieces back together.
Yes, I would prefer that as well.
The engine room looks pretty good to me. In the sense that it has the layout of an actual engine room. Everything is built around the engine.
Yes, which makes complete sense. And it's, you know, a giant reactor in the middle there, which something that you could imagine seeing and being the most important thing in the room.
Yeah, well, you've probably seen Titanic, right? And when they go down into the engine room, it's all built around these giant steam engines, right? And they run
the engines and the boilers and all the controls for them and all the plumbing. And
there's not much room for the people, you know, who service the engine. They're kind of crawling over it like ants. And that's the same here. So that looks good. And then he says something, I don't know who it was, maybe it was Trip, but he said that they use deflectors to prevent any kind of collision when they're traveling at warp. Now, I don't know what the actual physical speed, this has always been very confusing for me, right? Because the idea is you warp space and that propels you, but it also removes a lot of space. And that's how you can go faster than the speed of light.
Yes.
But your actual momentum is the part I've never really understood.
Yeah, there's, I mean, they never really get into it and how it works as opposed to other science fiction novels or genres where they talk about, you know, creating bubbles and, you know, getting out of actual space and stuff. But as you say, the interesting thing Tripp says, and even if only applies to their impulse engines going, you know, half the speed of light in a solar system, is you get hit by a little piece of rock and that punches a hole right through your ship.
Oh, that happens. So, yeah. That happens in orbit around Earth. I mean, they're just going like 45,000 miles an hour, you know, which would be nothing compared to what the Enterprise is traveling at. And a fleck of paint is like a bullet with that much kinetic energy. And so I've always been really kind of curious, because if you're going too fast, like if you were going half the speed of light, you've got to deal with time dilation. And so, you know, your time is passing a lot slower for you than it is for the place where you're headed. So I don't know. Anyway.
Well, we won't analyze the physics of Star Trek.
Yeah. And the only reason I do is because that was the show when I was growing up, that was the show you did talk about technical stuff with.
Yes.
Everything else was just, you know, it didn't start. You know, Star Wars is just half magic, you know.
Yep.
Star Trek was like, no, it works. And this is, you know, people write books on exactly how it works. So. So it is fun to ask the actual questions. You
know? How does it work?
Yeah.
Yeah.
What again?
I'm no physicist, so we're not going to talk about Aboukiri drives and, you know, warping space.
Time dilation and
time dilation and all that good stuff.
So they're getting ready to go. And of course you can't do anything in the military without an admiral giving a speech. So he gives a speech, and then, we get to see, a video of the That'll Do Pig guy who played the father of the warp drive.
Yes.
I can't remember his name right now. He's an excellent character actor, though. And he comes back for this as an old man to talk about the warp drive. And that, I thought that was nice that they tied into that, that movie. And then, let's see, it's the Boomer and the British guy, right, are kind of hanging around on the ceiling in the one place in the ship where there's no gravity.
Where the gravity cancels out.
Yeah. And then we get our first really that wouldn't fly today kind of subject matter when they start talking about Drolaxian women and their three breasts.
Yes. Well, it wouldn't fly today. You know, it probably flew with the original Enterprise. But yeah, they're trying to, I guess, do some bonding or something.
Yeah, but I'm just, you know, we've woken up a little bit since then. So
yes. Well, the whole series doesn't, you know, necessarily.
No, and I read an article that pissed me off so much the other day, and it was about, like, don't watch Friends because it doesn't age well. And I'm like, you know, you can't keep going back in time and trying to force modern wokeness on these shows that happened before all of that thought, you know, became suffused in pop culture. So it's fun. I think it's fun to make fun of it and kind of laugh at it and move on. But, you know, you can't really start throwing rocks.
Yeah, right. They're all shows of their time.
Yeah, and let's talk a minute about the Suliban, who are going to be the bad guys in this episode. what we know about them so far is that when they're chasing the Klingon in that cornfield and he goes into the methane tower or whatever and locks the door, one of them flattens out his arm and reaches up under the door.
Flattens out his whole body and goes under the door.
So they have some interesting capabilities that, you know, we don't know about. So they're killed in that methane. So we don't really see them again, the methane explosion. We don't see them again until after the Enterprise leaves dock. And then we cut to a scene of what is some sort of time chamber where someone from the future is communicating across the years to a Suliban at some place. We don't know where it is at this point.
Yes.
And he's basically saying, essentially what they're saying is that he's been giving them, the Suliban, adaptations to give them advantages. So sort of rushing evolution, and which I'm assuming he wants them to help him achieve some goal. You know, we don't know at this point, but that's what's going on. That's how the Suliban are getting this, are able to do these crazy things that they do.
And so, right. So they've left, they're taking the Klingon. Klingon's in their medical, the sick bay. They're trying to revive him and keep him alive. Dr. Phlox is fussing over him, and the Klingon recovers.
Right. And he starts talking. And so Hoshi tries to use the universal translator, and she can't, she says it won't lock in on his dialect.
Yeah. And I suspect that, as you've mentioned previously, the translator doesn't seem to be extremely good. So it's not going to, it seems to be having problems. We also discover a little bit that the Klingon really isn't completely with it.
Yeah, I think that's the actual problem, is that he's not making any sense, right? He's heavily sedated, and he's saying weird stuff. And eventually Hoshi understands that he's just saying random words. And that's why he can't pick. And so they're hanging out in the sick bay, and we're getting a good chance to see a lot of Dr. Phlox's scary looking treatments. Yeah, and Archer picks one up, and it starts rattling around in his hand, and he just quickly hands it off to Dr. Phlox.
Yes.
So this is kind of good-natured and everything, but the problem is that the Suliban are about to attack the ship with some technology that is not really well explained, but essentially they cause the ship to lose power. And everything goes dark.
Or some power. Yeah. Not gravity power. Not warp power. But all the lights go out. You know, they found the breaker box, I guess.
Yeah. It just slipped in there and flick and the master. Everything goes dark. So Hoshi is there. They've got an armed guard because the Klingon is awake now. And he has a plasma rifle?
Yes. He has a plasma rifle.
It's a plasma rifle, which would make me nervous in a ship, right?
Yeah.
But I guess you don't want a Klingon awake without a rifle on him, you know?
Or at least the humans don't understand why you would want
right.
that.
Right. And then there's the lights go out.
And we hear rats in the attic, effectively, little yes. skittling noises. Everybody gets.
And we see a really freaky scene of the Suliban crawling through a tunnel, some on like on the ceiling, some on the walls, and it's a very creepy effect. It's done very well.
Yes.
And then they drop down into the medical facility, and there's kind of a fight, and we see that the Suliban can become invisible when they want to, or mostly invisible.
Yep. Or camouflaged.
Yeah, it's more like chameleon, I guess, type, blending in with the background. And they take the Klingon.
Yes. But in the meantime, the security officer gets off a lucky shot and takes out one of the Suliban.
Right. We missed a scene that I thought was really important, and that is that on the first night out, Captain Archer has a dinner with Tucker and T'Pol.
Oh, yes.
And as they're bringing the food in, he makes a joke about they're having steak, and then he says to T'Pol, "Just kidding, I know you're a vegetarian." But then they bring the meals in, and Tucker and Archer are eating gigantic steaks in front of a vegetarian diplomat.
Who looks like she has a breadstick, a very crunchy breadstick that she's trying to cut with a knife and eat with a fork, because Vulcans don't touch their food. Yeah. It's a little overdone there. Yeah. You know, she'd have a plate of vegetables or something, but it was just amusing that they do that. It does bring out the point that their replicator technology is not very good, so they have to actually stock provisions.
Yeah.
Just like Phlox has to stock, you know, weird treatments. It looks like they're like they have to have a larder on their ship.
Yeah,
somewhere.
I mean, they would absolutely have to if they don't have the replicator technology. So.
Just hang it out in space, and it'll, you know, freeze dry.
Yeah. Good. Yeah. No problem keeping stuff cold.
Yeah.
I don't know. I liked the bit about, T'Pol saying Vulcans don't eat their food, don't touch their food with their hands. I think that mm-hmm. one of the things we're meant to sort of get a feeling for is that the Vulcans are as advanced from us as we are from Vikings, you know?
Yeah.
And I remember there's a great scene in the 13th Warrior where the Vikings are all sitting around and they've just woken up and they pass a bowl of water around, right? They splash this water in their face. They rinse their mouth out and spit it back into the bowl. Guys blow their nose into it. And then it goes on to the next guy, and he washes his face with this nasty water, right? And he goes around, and there's an Arab played by Omar Sharif who's just kind of telling his charge, you know, this is how their community binds itself, right? Yes. But to us, that just seems so primitive, right? And that's how the Vulcans feel about us. You know, the things that we think of are just binding rituals are just, you know, ghastly to them. So anyway, so now they've lost the alien. They've lost the Klingon, sorry.
They've gained a Suliban, and they've lost the trail of the Suliban ship because it's more advanced.
And T'Pol's first instinct is turn around and go back. We're done. We don't have the Klingon. Yep. We can't succeed with the mission. We just go back and we'll use the facilities on Earth to figure out where they went and try to blah, 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 whatever. Basically, she's done. But Archer is not done. And he reminds her that she is the science officer and he's the captain and they're going to find that Klingon. Anyway, he wants someone to figure out how to trace the Suliban's warp decay so they can follow. Then, so they go to...
Yes, they manage to get a trace. They follow them. Let's see. That's where the Klingon was coming from.
Right. Oh, right, right, right. Okay, right. That's how they...
I think they managed to get that information. They first heard Rigel from the Klingon. They got that right. As part of the conversation.
Okay.
And so they're headed to Rigel 10. I think they got that from Klang before he disappeared. Right. He muttered something about Rigel 10. And so they're on their way to Rigel 10. They get there. It's an interesting little facility on the surface of a very cold planet.
Well, yeah, I thought that was interesting because, you know, 100 years after meeting the Vulcans, Earth, everyone is now upper middle class and there's no war and there's no poverty. And yet this Rigel that's been around a lot longer than we have is just nasty.
Oh yeah.
Everyone is poor and dirty and
it's sort of the post-apocalyptic thing. Or, you know, maybe it's the things don't always go so well for cultures, but it certainly is an interesting place. One of the things we see, very interesting, they take a shuttle to the planet. There are no transporting, right. Shuttle down. And guess who's leading the away team?
Of course, I have that note. Why? Why does the captain go on the away team?
Well, we're back to original series male dominant character.
This is very reminiscent of Kirk beaming down with.
Yes,
it's like if you wanted to cripple a ship by taking out its top five officers, just wait for them to come down to your planet on their way.
And in there, they're halfway down to the shuttle and take them out with a missile. Yay!
Exactly. It'd be like an admiral leaving his aircraft carrier to go ashore, you know, to attack the Japanese or something. So anyway, but yeah, so it's, you know, you have to buy it because that's the way these shows are.
That's right. Well, they have to make their plot line stick.
Yeah.
But it's a fairly exotic place. Yeah. We see some interesting aliens. Trip and Malcolm go to what essentially looks like a strip club.
Yeah.
Yes. where the dancers are eating butterflies, yes, or moths,
acting
or something
them out of the air with their tongues. Yeah, I guess, you know, that's just, again, that was, you know, the kind of exploitation I would have thought would have been done away with by this time if we were able to do away with it. But I get the feeling that maybe Rigel is kind of one of those outside the laws of everybody. It's where you go to get dirty, you know?
Yes, it is. The Klingons have live food there. Yeah. It's interesting, though, T'Pol sort of schools Trip on dealing with alien cultures. It's like she points out that, yeah, you're acting just like Hicks going to visit the city for the first time. We're the noobs. You don't understand stuff. Don't jump to conclusions. You know, don't be quick to act. Think a little bit.
When you're new somewhere, look around first. So Archer ends up getting captured by some Suliban.
They're watching the away team.
So everybody is captured. A beautiful female Suliban makes out with Archer, which I think beats Kirk's record by a couple of episodes. Yes. Straight out of the gate, making out with the aliens.
Yep.
It turns out there's a point to that. She can read his, I don't know, which she can tell whether he's telling the truth by kissing him. And it turns out she's actually with the resistance, the people that are fighting, the Suliban who are fighting the Suliban who are trying to get evolved up in a hurry.
Right. Right, so she's a rebel. They call the Suliban who are trying to sow this discord among the Klingons the Cabal.
Oh, that's right. We should definitely have said that earlier. The whole plan with the Suliban is they're trying to start a war with the Klingons, between the Klingons and the Vulcans, and that's what Klang the Klingon is. His whole point is he's a messenger, that he's supposed to bring back information to the Klingons to explain that this is not what's going on, is the Suliban are trying to start war.
Yes. Between Klingon factions and specifically the Suliban, I don't even remember her name, said something to the effect that they didn't want the Vulcans and the humans involved yet. That was going to be later. Because it just would mess things up. Saren is her name.
Yeah. So now we're filled in. So we know who the players are. We know what the point is. We know what has to be done.
Right. She's mentioned that it's a temporal Cold War. The sources from the distant future manipulating us.
So now we know that why they want Klang so bad, because they want to know what message he's carrying.
And also to prevent him from delivering it, no doubt.
Yes. Yeah. But you notice once they get a hold of him, they don't kill him. They just try to figure out what the message is. So there's a really good shootout. At this point, the bad Suliban attack the good Suliban and our away team. Everyone gets their guns. And then there's just a really, I thought, a very nice shootout with some really good special effects. People actually getting killed.
Yes. People escaping. Lots of running around and the Suliban resistance shooting the Suliban cabal.
Yeah.
And it's all very...
None of the away team dies.
Yes. Well, you know, because they're all good shots.
Now, it's interesting because the Suliban guns are ray guns, but the away team's guns seem to fire like plasma bullets. So it has a good look to it because you've got like these red, you know, bullets flying one direction and these yellow beams coming back the other direction. And people actually get hit. You know, it's like in drop, you know, in the original series, they disappeared if you hit them with a phaser. So yeah. It's like, that's the perfect murder weapon.
It was so powerful.
There's no body. So anyway, they have this shootout.
Archer gets injured, saving T'Pol.
Well, no, T'Pol is knocked down into the line of fire and drops her gun. Sends Tucker or Malcolm back to the shuttle with Hoshi because she's panicking again. This is what annoys me about her. She doesn't belong in a starship. She panics every time something goes wrong. Archer actually does the two-fisted gun thing to cover T'Pol to get her back to the thing. And just as he's about to get on board, he's shot. And it's funny because, you know, because it's a ray beam, right? Beam of light. Yeah. It looks very much like the Suliban stood up and just on purpose shot him in the hip.
Yeah, that's right.
I want you to suffer.
Take you back and make you care for them. You know, injured soldiers are better than dead soldiers.
So they shoot their way out of there, and then the boomer pilots the shuttle out under fire,
and they get back to the ship. Yes, we have a flashback. The captain, while the captain is hallucinating, he gets some trust the wind comment from his father,
right,
which we'll play in later. And they get back to the ship, and they have to go through.
Now, this brought up something really interesting for me, because I hadn't thought about it before this point, but they do. They go through the decontamination chamber, her and Trip, and for some reason they have to they have to strip down to their skivvies and rub lotion on each other.
Gel up.
Meanwhile, they're just really hating on each other the whole time. I just expected them to do that thing where you get so angry you make out, you know, kind of thing.
Yep.
but what it brought up to me was the fact that when she's not mostly naked, her uniform is very tight fitting. It's to show her figure. And Vulcans don't even have attractive haircuts, right? They literally don't care how they look, but she is everything that she wears really shows off that figure.
Yeah. Well, you know, again, if everything she wears, now you remember all the other Vulcans, they were wearing robes. Long flowing, you know, generic robes. So yeah, it's a thing for the men.
Boy, I tell you what, you can practically just count the freckles, underneath her uniform, underneath her t-shirt. It's so tight. So it was definitely an attempt to lure in the male viewer, I guess.
Yes. Yeah, no doubt about it. So then we also get to see Phlox practice some of his unconventional medicine on Archer, the osmotic eel, which I just loved.
Well, yeah, I mean, if you have a snake phobia, you're not going to like that. That part of the show. they heal up Archer, and oh dang, I have a note here that just says the transporting device, and I don't know why.
Yeah. But anyway, so yeah, they heal up Archer, but T'Pol is taken while he's incapacitated. She's taken command, being second in command, and she's debating, you know, she's again, there's a little conflict about Vulcan interference, and she's making the point that she's in command. She's going to decide what to do. Trip brings up something about the captain wouldn't quit. T'Pol actually surprises the captain by following his plan instead of, or you know, the plan that that Trip says the captain would have advocated, which was continuing on. I did notice one interesting thing. This is again a pointer to a new crew, you know, not having Starfleet really hasn't got its act together yet. When the captain comes onto the bridge, there's no relieving anybody of command. There's no, you know, passing the command back and forth, no clear chain of command. It's just, he walks on and everybody just kind of, oh, okay, captain.
That's
here,
true. We see a lot of that. We saw a lot of that in the TNG pilot, which was, you know, come to attention, salute, and speak in a loud, clear voice, and you know, say the words in the right order. And these guys just walk around and call each other by their first name.
Yep. And you know, it's not clear who's in command, who's supposed to be doing what, but, you know, I guess, you know, it's informal. They make it work. As much as that is kind of just kind of grating for a Starfleet, you know, for a military, for at least a quasi military ship. But
for me, it's, you know, having been in the military, I never saw any kind of thing where you didn't have saluting and officers were called by their first name and this kind of stuff. But like you said, this is a research, essentially a research and diplomatic vessel. They even ask at one point, he goes, why do we need weapons? And it's just basically that he says just for self-defense. So she decides to go ahead with his plan and actually helps figure out a way to track where the Suliban ships went.
Mostly T'Pol. They track the Suliban. They discover not only one Suliban ship, but a bunch of Suliban ships. And as a matter of fact, a Suliban base hidden in the atmosphere of a gas giant.
Yeah, like. And it's basically a magnetic pole, and just like thousands of these Suliban ships just attached to it.
We get a little flash into the the Suliban cabal talking to the future. I think they call him the future man or smoking future man, kind of like smoking man from the X-Files. And he's basically the humans. He's adamant that the humans can't find the Helix, which is this apparently this time.
Oh, the place where he does his talking,
The humans and the Vulcans weren't supposed to be involved yet, and that Saren's message can't reach Kronos, Kronos being the headquarters, being the capital of the Klingon Empire. Unbeknownst to them, the humans have discovered the Cabal's base.
Yes.
Being humans, they lure a trap and use a fishing line to go catch one of these little Suliban ships.
I was absolutely just aghast when I saw the grappler. I was like, no. This is not something they would have on a brand new prototype. You know, it's like, what else? We got a little extra room. What do you want? Well, how about a giant grappling gun?
Grappler.
But I guess it was necessary because they didn't want to use the transporting device.
Yes. And they don't have tractor beams yet.
They literally have to physically grab one of these ships. Fortunately, they're small. So let's just say what the plan is, right? The plan is that they're going to go infiltrate the Suliban headquarters by stealing this ship and getting attached to it and go in there, grab the Klingon, and get out. And the Enterprise is going to wait up in one of the layers of, I can't remember what it was. It was sulfur or something like that, where they wouldn't be able to be seen. And this is where, as so often happens with the Star Trek movies, it becomes a submarine movie, right? It's they're sitting quietly and they're being depth charged
in reverse.
The Sulubans are flying around underneath this layer of sulfur and they're trying to find them. And so they're just shooting explosive, mines or whatever
charges. Yes. We get a little interesting vignette before they actually take off to go infiltrate the base. T'Pol actually shows some concern for the captain and the mission. A little unexpected emotion there, and in particular, she explains why, which is the Vulcan High Command is going to hold her responsible if anything happens to Archer. She's somewhat highly motivated to make this successful.
The other thing I thought was really interesting in the light of like the Independence Day nonsense was that they literally had to learn how to use the controls of the Suliban ship, right?
Yes. play around with it, poke buttons, try things out, see what works. Hope they don't launch the weapons in the the shuttle bay.
So often it's just like an Earthling jumps into this advanced ship and just starts pressing buttons and, oh, that's how that works. And blang, they go flying away. Trip had to learn how to do that.
Just before they leave, finally, you get your phase pistols.
Right.
They have two settings.
Right. The phasers make their first, they make their debut. They go and they are able to infiltrate the Suliban base. They find the Klingon, Klang, and they free him. One of the things that I thought was so funny was that as they're trying to sneak out, Klingons can't whisper, right?
Yes.
They're telling him to be quiet. He's like, and of course, you know, this is the standard thing in just all television shows, but the key person has to stay behind to set a bomb that has a very short fuse.
Yes. But at least it's an EM pulse. It's not some sort of actually blow things up.
Right. The idea is it's going to turn off the magnetic attachments and all the ships are just going to fall away from the base, which will cause a lot of confusion. Makes sense. But again, you probably wouldn't leave your captain to do that. And I don't know, I guess at this point in human history, they haven't discovered the timer yet because Yes. Archer has to wait for them to leave and then set off the bomb.
Yep.
Now he, but you know, it's very fortunate he did decide to do that because, he starts wandering around because he gets cut off from the ship and he starts wandering.
There's nobody there. Yeah. You know, it's like all their ships have floated away and nobody's like running around panicking, yeah, trying to get them back.
My thought was, well, I guess everybody's out trying to get the ships back and that's why the corridor is empty, you know?
Yep.
But he wanders down to the most secure room in the whole place, yeah, the Helix place. And just walk there.
Yeah. Now let's before we get there, the Trip and Trip and Malcolm, Trip and Boomer, the navigator, have taken the Klingon back, or they're trying to get back to the ship. The ship had to move, and we get a little Hoshi magic here. She hears Trip's voice, or hears Trip's communications out of all the static that that's going on, but they had to move. Trip can't find him, so they use the old light the plasma drive as a beacon so that the Enterprise can find them, and of course everybody else would see them as well. Like, oh, yeah, let's go there, but apparently not.
Yeah. So.
So anyway, we're back to the base, and Archer finds the right. Helix room and discovers the timey phase effect.
Yeah, it's sort of like the room exists in two different times at once, and so you sort of move in waves, and nothing is, time doesn't move at its natural rhythm in that room. He starts looking around, and the Suliban does Future Man show up and start?
No, I think it's Saren. It's the guy who was talking to
Future Man. Oh, okay.
Or, I mean, not Saren. Saren was the other guy. It's the head of the Cabal, whatever his name was. I don't think we ever learned it. He shows up because he was talking to Future Man, and Future Man said they can't find out. So Cabal guy shows up,
it's a good fight. It's a good fight, especially because of the fact that they're having it in the Helix room. They have to compensate for the fact that they don't know when their bullet is going to hit its target.
And Archer takes advantage of it. I'm surprised the Cabal guy didn't use it to better effect, but it's an interesting fight, and you get an idea about the time dilation and the weird, you know, multidimensional aspect of the room. Archer gets away. He's running down the hall, and is the base about to explode? I don't understand what the deal is, but the Enterprise is coming to get him, and they're getting shot at a lot, and they have to make a quick escape, and they don't have time to go get Archer off of the base before they get knocked out of commission. So what do? They use the transporter.
That would have been so funny if he would have come back all wrong.
Just like in Galaxy Quest. That was my favorite scene where the thing comes.
Hold, please.
Yeah. It's Inside Out. Galaxy Quest, the best Star Trek movie ever.
God, I know. Still my favorite Star Trek movie is Galaxy Quest. Absolutely. Okay. And so they get back to the ship, and then they fly off with Klang and go to Kronos, and they have a much less bloody welcome than I would have expected of the Klingons.
Yes.
And apparently they're not mad at Klang for being alive. And it turns out that the message was coded into his DNA. That's why he couldn't tell the Suliban the message. He didn't know it. It was in his
blood. They actually, and it was a great, great little scene. You know, Archer thinks they're going to go kill him, but no, they actually just get some of his blood. Of course they do it the Klingon way, where they slice his palm and it drips into a vial.
You take it directly from your heart. No,
that's right. No needles, sterile stuff. Just get out your blade, give us some blood.
So that goes well. Better than anything in other shows when the Vulcans are involved. Where the Klingons are involved. Yeah. Actually, they have a far more animosity in their relationship with the Vulcans than they do with the Klingons.
Yep.
And then they decide, and then we have a nice scene because T'Pol was only supposed to be on the ship for this one mission.
Right. And Starfleet has decided that the mission is going to extend. They're not going to go home.
They're heading out. Yeah. And so Archer does something interesting. He basically says he can't lose face by asking for her to stay. So she needs to request to stay. And she does.
And then they head out on their mission.
And that's the beginning of what I thought was a very, very much more enjoyable show than the Next Generation one.
It made for a really good pair of first show pilots. It got you involved with the crew, the annoying ones, the funny ones, the doctor who has the really creepy smile.
Yes.
who seems like a great character. T'Pol, who seems like she's actually going to be an asset to the crew after all.
And she also seems to be kind of softening on the whole human thing.
Even though she's not a Starfleet officer, it's actually refreshing to see, some cooperation there. That's the thawing of that's supposed to be the thawing of the relationship between the Vulcans.
I look forward to coming back here whenever we get a chance. Next week, what are we going to do? Do we think we can? I'm trying to figure out. I don't know if I can get Farscape in time, but I'm going to try.
Okay. Yes. So if you can't get the first episode of Farscape, I propose that we either venture a little bit more into the Star Trek Enterprise universe. Deep Space Nine is, I think, too involved in the middle of Star Trek Next Generation. It leaps right into the Borg. When we don't have that context yet. So just like the Star Trek movie that you saw that showed the Borg way before we get this series and way before Deep Space Nine started out. So let's hold
what
off
about on Babylon 5.
I'd be happy to do either Babylon 5, another Enterprise, or if you can get Farscape.
Yeah, my goal is to get Starscape, Farscape. What about, do we want to include in our list of shows that we want to sample, do we want to do things like Stargate?
Stargate. Stargate's a fun one. I really like it. It's also got 10 years worth of episodes.
Well, again, I'm just talking about doing pilots right now to try to pick one. And then even then, we'll just do five or six episodes of their best episodes or whatever.
If we're going to do Stargate, we should start with the movie.
Ooh, that would be fun. I loved that movie. I saw that movie in the theater and I dug it. Absolutely.
No, I'm happy to do, if we do enough Stargate, we'll discover that, Farscape characters move to that show after Farscape gets canceled. So, for that matter, characters from Firefly moved to Stargate
characters?
As well.
So.
Or not characters.
Yeah, okay,
but
I was
actors,
gonna say
actors,
that would be actors, weird.
Not characters. Sorry, not characters. Actors and actresses.
Okay, so let's. I'm gonna try to get a hold of the Farscape, and if I can't, let's plan on doing the movie, Stargate movie.
Stargate movie.
Okay.
Sounds good.
All right, good. I will be emailing you with updates and all that kind of stuff. And so I'm going to go ahead and sign off now and invite everybody to come back next week for whatever happens then.
Sounds good. This is Mike Slocum. I've had a great time.
This is Jake McMillan. I have too. We'll talk to you next week.